For a little while this morning, I would like to study Psalm 50. And we just read it not too long ago in our services. And I don't know, it just really caught my eye. There's a lot of neat little things in Psalm 50. And I just entitled this a psalm for today. So if you have the Pew Bible, I believe it's on page 820. And so we're just going to go through this psalm. There's a couple little things that just kind of pop out that I want to explain. I know some we've talked about in the past, some we haven't, kind of keep it a little interesting. But the main part I want to look at is towards the end, is that this is like a legal case. And so God is really going to bring His judgment against His people. And He's going to list the indictment against His nation. And it's really neat because I think it fits perfectly with what we are dealing with today. So turn to Psalm 50. And after prayer, we will take a little time to study this very interesting little passage. Well, I, for one, really like music, pretty much like any genre. I've been kind of on a post-Beatles Paul McCartney kick lately. The kids are trying to get me into something called One Direction. That's, if you're not under the age of 30, you've never heard of One Direction. I'm trying, Aaron, I'm trying, but it's tough. But I've always wondered, I wonder what the psalms sounded like. Because you know, these were songs that they sang. And I kind of did a little research, and really nobody knows what these sounded like. There's no musical direction to it. I don't know if it sounded more like a chant, or if it was like a dirge, what we might call it, or if it had musical attributes to it, or if there was a set tune that went with it. I don't know. I've always been kind of curious about that. This is Psalm 50. It also says, it's God the righteous judge. Now, these were just kind of titles that had been added to by editors over the year. And it also says a psalm of Asaph. And so we're going to talk about Asaph here in a little bit when we start talking about timing. But really, nobody knows exactly when the psalms were written. It's not like as though they were written in order, starting with number one and moved chronologically. They were moved around and they were put into different groups and in different sections. But this is a really interesting psalm. So again, I wish I could sing it to you, but I don't know the tune, I don't know how it went, so we're just going to have to read it as if it's almost poetry. So Psalm 50, the mighty one, God the Lord, has spoken and called the earth from the rising of the sun to its going down. Out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God will shine forth. Our God shall come and shall not keep silent. A fire shall devour before Him, and it shall be very tempestuous all around Him. That's a very flowering, flowing imagery to begin this psalm. And there's something important to that. And what I want you to notice is this is a legal proceeding. This is a legal document. And so he begins by saying the mighty one, God, the Lord. Those are three separate names for God that just show the majesty. Spurgeon says El Elohim and Jehovah, three glorious names for the God of Israel. And so a lot of times, and you've seen legal documents. I remember some of the ones when Dad was mayor, they'd make a proclamation. Well, you'd always start off with this fancy introduction, and you would use a lot of words like whereunto and whereas and hither and all these fancy words that you never say in normal conversation, but it was used in the introduction of this great document or proclamation. And so God is calling Himself these majestic names. It's the way you would do it in an old covenant. It's the way you would do it in a legal proceeding. And in fact, we've kind of carried some of that into our society as well. We go to court. What's the bailiff say? All rise. The court is now in session. The Honorable Judge Joseph Wapner presiding. You know, we always begin with this great flowing, flowery speech. The Honorable Judge now presiding. And that's what God is doing here. He is calling Himself as the judge. So please don't ever forget this. God's people have entered into a formal legal covenant. And there are a lot of folks in the world, I'm afraid today, that would take being called into the courts very, very seriously. But then when it comes to religious matter, we become very flippant with it. And that's a shame. Because we talk about the new covenant in His blood. It's a covenant. And so we need to remember that, and with all the due respect and honor that we would give our court cases, How much more then should we give the covenant that we have entered into with God? So don't forget this. This is a covenant. So listen to what the Lord said. Verse 4. He shall call to the heavens from above and to the earth that he may judge his people. Gather my saints together to me, those who have made a covenant with me by sacrifice. Let the heavens declare his righteousness, for God himself is judge. Selah. So this is a court proceeding. And the judge has just now entered the room, and now he is calling to witness all of those that were part of his covenant. Now there's a little note here on my Bible. There's a little footnote where it says, made a covenant. And normally I just delete those little footnotes. I left that one in. So it depends what kind of, which translation you're reading. Or you may have one that has a little note there, the same as mine, where it says, made a covenant. And then mine goes down to the bottom of the footnote, and it says, literally, that means to cut. To cut a covenant. And that reminded me of something I studied not too long ago. Thought I'll throw that back out here. The idea of cutting a covenant. That was an old-timey way of representing a covenant. You had to cut something. You had to cut an animal. There's two verses or two passages I can show you to kind of explain that. One is Jeremiah 34 and 18. Jeremiah 34 and 18, and I will give the men who have transgressed my covenant, who have not performed the words of the covenant which they made before me, when they cut the calf in two and passed between the parts of it. That's a little interesting, isn't it? Nowadays, we shake a hand or we get something notarized and signed. Well, back in ancient times, you know how they ratified a covenant? They cut an animal in half. And they had to walk between the two bits of the carcass. That's kind of interesting. Now, Erin had a good question today. She said, did they cut him this way? Look at that. Or did they cut him this way? And the answer is, I have no idea. I would assume, if I remember my biological anatomy and physiology, that's called a sagittal cut. I would assume they would cut him sagittal. And that way it would be the same on either, have like a mirror image. But it'd probably be a whole lot easier to cut them transversely, if I'd use the right word there. You would cut them right through the middle. I don't know. I'm assuming it was a sagittal cut, but that beast would be cut. You'd have to walk in between the two pieces of that animal to ratify the covenant. There's one more that talks about it. It's Genesis chapter 15. This is where God makes his covenant with Abraham. Genesis 15 and 10, then he brought all these. And we find out from the preceding verses, these means the heifer, goat, ram, turtle dove, and pigeon. He had to bring all these animals together. God told him to. It says that he cut them in two down the middle. So I'm assuming that means this way. And placed each piece opposite the other. But he did not cut the birds in two. Verse 17, and it came to pass when the sun went down and it was dark, there appeared a smoking oven and a burning torch that passed between the pieces. Pretty interesting. Kind of a weird sight. God, in this form of light, passed between these pieces. In other words, God ratified the covenant with Abraham more than Abraham ratified the covenant with God. Let me say that one more time. God ratified the covenant with Abraham more than Abraham ratified the covenant with God. That's kind of interesting that God walked right down the middle of those two carcasses. So that kind of imagery is brought up again here, the idea of cutting the covenant. This is something that's very, very serious. All right, let's go back to our court scene. Verse 7. Hear, O my people, and I will speak, O Israel, and I will testify against you. I am God, your God. So God is in a little bit unique position because in verse 6 he called himself the judge, and now he's going to testify against his nation. So he's kind of in a role of a prosecutor and as the judge. Have you ever stopped and think about how many court scenes are found in the Bible? And how much imagery is used to legal proceedings? If you stop and think about it, there's really a lot. Here's a couple examples. One is from Daniel. Daniel chapter 7, and I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated, representing God as being the judge. It said 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him, the court was seated, and the books were opened. This whole imagery of a court scene, and God the judge, and the people being brought before him. Same thing happens in Revelation. Go back and read Revelation 4. And you get the same imagery of a court. You know, it's just something that all through the Scriptures, this imagery of the courtroom and the judge, very, very important to God, because we are under a legal binding document with God. We have a covenant with God. Think of all these words that the Bible uses. You can get a lesson on Judge Judy right here. Law, justified, guilt, penalty, petition, throne, heaven's court, advocate, witness, bribe, adversary. I was just thinking off the top of my head. All these different legal words that are found in the Scriptures. There's a whole bunch of them. Because that's the way God sees it. It's law. There's right and there's wrong. You're either with the law or you're against the law. It's very important for us to understand. Verse 8. Now God's going to attack their sacrifices. He says, I will not rebuke you for your sacrifices or your burnt offerings, which are continually before me. I will not take a bull from your house, nor goats out of your fold. For every beast of the forest is mine, and the cattle on 1,000 hills. I know all the birds of the mountain, and the wild beasts of the field are mine. Remember where it got to the point in Isaiah where God said, listen, I don't want any more of your sacrifices. I don't want any more of your incense. It stinks. I don't want you giving me anything else because the nation wasn't doing it correctly. He said, I don't want any of it. And so God's kind of reinforcing this idea. Does God need the bulls and the goats? Does he need the beast and the cattle? Does he need the birds? Does he need that? And the answer is obviously not. God doesn't need it. He has it anyway. Spurgeon says it like this. Foolishly they dreamed that bullets with horns and hooves could please the Lord, when indeed he sought for hearts and souls. The nation of Israel missed the point. Oh, they would offer their sacrifices. They would kill the bulls and the goats like they were supposed to. But they weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing with the right heart. They were going through the motions of it, but they just flat were not quite doing it in the right means. It has to do with intent. You know, outcome is one thing. Intent is something different. So what about intent and outcome? Isn't that kind of what Samuel was trying to teach? 1 Samuel 15 and 22, remember what he said to Saul? Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. You can do the sacrifices, but if you are not obeying the voice of the Lord, the sacrifice means nothing. Because God doesn't need it. God doesn't need the animals. He's already God. They're His. So the idea of sacrificing without obedience, you can be going through the motions and doing what it says to do technically and still be out of alignment or out of accord with God's Word. Isn't that what 1 Corinthians chapter 11 is trying to teach us too? In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, as it's talking about the Lord's Supper, the Corinthian church, the congregation there, was doing something. They were fulfilling the Lord's Supper. Now, I assume they were doing it correctly. I assume. Other than the fact was that they weren't doing it all as one group. And they were kind of doing it in different parts, and people were late. Some people brought their own food. They had some issues going on with the Lord's Supper. Now, there's a very scary verse here, verse 17. And he says, now when given these instructions, so Paul's going to reiterate the instructions to make sure they understand. One more time, here's what I want you to do. He says, I do not praise you, since you come together not for the better, but for the worse. So you mean you can be doing something that's religious? You can be following something in the Bible and fulfilling that outcome? But, he says, you're coming together not for the better, but for the worse. That's a very scary verse to me. Because that means that's intent. It's not just the outcome. You know, we don't rush through everything just to make sure, well, it says here, we got to do it. Okay, let's do it real fast. There's always intent with it as well. It's kind of like giving of means. I guess if you threw a penny in, I mean, you've technically fulfilled the outcome, but God also says, man, you're supposed to do it as you purposed and as you prospered and as you thought about it. It's supposed to be something that's important. Intent is just as important, if not more important, than outcome. That's kind of scary to me. So we need to be careful that what we're doing is in the right way. Because you know what? God doesn't need any of this. God has it all. He continues in verse 12, and he says it like this: if I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine in all its fullness. Will I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of goats? He's kind of asking some rhetorical questions. If I was, as God, if I was hungry, do you think I'd come down and tell you all? He says, I don't need your help. And he doesn't. Everything belongs to the Lord. What can he need, who is owner of all things and able to create as he wills? Again, that's Charles Spurgeon's comment. So what are we supposed to do then? What are our duties? What should the nation of Israel have done? What's our responsibility? If God has all and owns all and all belongs to God, what then does God expect us to do? Well, in the 14th verse, he explains it to us. Here are our duties. Verse 14, offer to God thanksgiving and pay your vows to the Most High. Call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver you and you shall glorify me. There you go. You want to know what we're responsible for? Look at the verbs. Just pull the verbs out. Offer thanksgiving. That hasn't changed. God still expects us to offer thanksgiving to him. He says pay our vows. Again, it's another legal term, isn't it? We have to pay our vows. We have a responsibility to him to do what he has told us to do. We have to pay our vows. We have to keep up our end of the bargain. Thirdly, we need to call upon God when we come into times of trouble and need. And then, it's kind of interesting, he says if you do all these three things, if you offer thanksgiving, pay our vows, and call upon God, he says, I'll deliver you. God will deliver us, and that's how we glorify God. Isn't that interesting? How do we glorify God today? Same way. Offer thanksgiving to him. We need to pay our vows, do what we've been required to do, and then we need to call upon God in times of trouble. And if we do that, we are glorifying God. I don't think any of that has changed today as well. So he said, nation of Israel, here's what I want you to do. He says, forget about those other sacrifices. I mean, that was what they were supposed to do, but that wasn't the intent. You got to remember, the Old Testament was a shadow of what was to come in the New Testament. God didn't really need the sacrifice of bulls and goats. He didn't need the sacrifice of turtle doves and birds of the mountain. He didn't need that. What did he want? Well, Paul says it in Romans 12 and 1. You know where it was all headed? I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. Now, that verse kind of has a little bit deeper meaning to me now. God didn't need those other sacrifices. In the fullness of time, when we got to the New Testament era, and we have the blood of Christ, he didn't want the sacrifice of bulls and goats. That's not what it's about. He wants us. He wants our sacrifice. He wants our lives. We are to be a living sacrifice. Pretty powerful, is it not? Okay, so now we get to the fun part. This is where God the judge is going to bring judgment. Verse 16, but to the wicked God says, what right have you to declare my statutes or take my covenant in your mouth? So he talks to the unrighteous, to the wicked people who were sitting there, spilling out religious things and speaking the law, even though they weren't righteous themselves. And God says, who do you think you are? Who do you think you are to stand up, you wicked person, and try to sit there and declare my laws or take my covenant when you don't even know what's going on? Have you ever been accosted by someone who has basically no information of the Bible and sits there and just rips you and tells you how wrong you are? And you've got to kind of bite your tongue a little bit, but they don't have any idea, but yet they feel that they have the right to just let you have it. As a coach, I get to do this all the time. I get yelled at by people telling me what plays I should run, and I got the wrong people, and they don't even know the rules of the game. They have no idea, but yet they feel that they have the right to, come after you. And God says to the wicked, he said, that's the same way. Who do you think you are that you can come up, you're wicked, you're sinful, but yet you can spout out the word and you can spout out my covenant when you have not been keeping it yourself? Now we get to the formal verdict. I put verse 6 back up there again. Remember, this is God the judge. Let the heavens declare his righteousness, for God himself is judge. So now the trial is coming to an end. and God is going to bring forth the verdict. And so he has verses 17 through 20. I have considered this five separate counts that are against, that have brought forth the nation of Israel. You might see a different number, but I've considered this five separate counts. So we're going to read it in continuity here, and then we'll pull out the five separate. Seeing you hate instruction and cast my words behind you. When you saw a thief, you consented with him, and have been a partaker with adulterers. You give your mouth to evil, and your tongue frames deceit. You sin and speak against your brother. You slander your own mother's son. So I see that as five separate counts. You know how you have the indictment, and you have the counts of indictment, and then the judge or the jury has to make a ruling on each individual count? It's the same one. So here we go. Count number one. Seeing you hate instruction and cast my words behind you. So they don't want to hear the truth. They don't want to learn anything. They don't want to hear what the Word of God says. They hate instruction. Now here's the thing. We're required to follow all instruction. Even if we don't like it. Even if personally we don't agree with it. Even if we wish it wasn't in the Bible. That does not give us the right to what he says is cast it behind our backs. When you cast something behind your back, that means you're not going to see it anymore. It's out of sight, it's out of mind. You're not going to deal with it anymore. It's like you pretend like it's not there. It's a very presumptuous act. We're not sinning out of ignorance. We're not sinning because we misunderstand something or have a misconception. We're sinning because we have chosen to throw it behind our back. That way we can't see it anymore, and if we can't see it, then that feels like we can do whatever we want to. Does that phrase, cast my words behind you, does that ring a bell anywhere? Does that ring a bell with anywhere else in the Scriptures? 1 Kings 14 and 9. It's our old buddy Jeroboam again. You know, it seems like Jeroboam's gotten a lot of press over the last couple of weeks. Jeroboam, remember, he was the king that disrupted all of the religion, and he just flat out ignored what the Word said. The Word said, go to the temple in Jerusalem. He said, no, we're going to make our own in Dan and Bethel. Worship God. No, we're going to make a calf. Priests have to be Levites. No, that can be anything. Whatever he needed to do, he just flat out ignored the word of the Lord. It says, Jeroboam has done more evil than all who were before you, for you have gone and made for yourself other gods and molded images to provoke me to anger, and have cast me behind your back. It's that imagery of just throwing it behind me. Now, which came first? Did the song come first, and then was it used to reference Jeroboam? Or did Jeroboam come first, and the song referenced Jeroboam? I don't know. Remember it said it was a song of Asaph? If it's meaning Asaph, who was one of the singers in David's court, then that means the song was written first. And then this kind of imagery is picked up on a couple hundred years later. But Asaph is also a family name. So some people think, well, I think, no, that Jeroboam occurred first, and the song was written. It's just the song of Asaph. It's like a section of songs. I don't know. But one is kind of in reference to the other. I just can't tell you which one came first. But this idea of casting behind the back, that's like basically saying, I can't see it anymore, so I can do whatever I want to do. There's count number one. Count number two. When you saw a thief, you consented with him. You saw a thief, you consented with him. Again, I left my little footnote up here. Consented. This one has, remember LXX, we talked about that. That's the Septuagint, so that's that old translation, the Greek translation. It means to run. So in other words, you could translate it as, you are running with thieves. It didn't say they were thieves. It didn't say they stole anything, but they were running with thieves. Today we'd probably say they're running with a bad crowd. Right? They weren't necessarily guilty of the mistakes and the sins of the thieves. It never says they were thieves themselves. But you know what? They were supporting those that were guilty. And I thought about this verse in Romans 1 and 32. Now, Romans 1 and 32, Paul lists an entire category of sins. And then he says, who knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. And that is a scary verse. That is a scary verse. That's running with thieves. And it doesn't matter if you're a thief or not. It doesn't matter if you're actually participating in that event. If you're running with them, you're just as guilty. To me, that's very, very scary. I got a book here. This is Carl Johnson's book. I don't know if anybody got this for such a time as this. I want to read a passage of Carl's. This is pretty good. Because he talks about the word tolerance. Okay, so this is one of Carl's passages. But I think this is important. This is what Carl says. He says, about 20 years ago, I wrote an article that I perceived to be an effort by our culture to redefine the meaning of the word tolerance. He says, in Webster's 1997 edition of its New World Dictionary, tolerate is defined as to recognize and respect others' beliefs and practices without sharing them, and to bear or put up with something or something not especially liked. And he says, although the word tolerant is not used in the New Testament, Paul expresses the essence of the word in 1 Corinthians 13 and 7 when he said, charity endures all things. And the word endure derives from the Latin tolerare, which is where we get the word tolerate or tolerance from. However, Carl continues, in the past 20 years, however, our culture has gradually fostered upon us a new definition of tolerance. Today, if you do not approve and endorse a person's beliefs and lifestyle, you are being accused of hating the person and being intolerant, insensitive, and bigoted. Almost every time you hear the word tolerance spoken today outside the walls of the church, by school teachers, news anchors, government officials, activists, celebrities, perhaps even your own children and grandchildren, this is the definition that is meant. And I think he's really on to something. That if we don't support, even if we think it's wrong, even if we know in the Bible it's wrong, if you don't support it, oh, you're intolerant, you're hateful, and you're a bigot, how can you be a Christian? And that is not what the word tolerant means. Tolerant, sometimes you got to accept things that people do. We can't be responsible for the actions of everybody else in the world. We don't get to go out and attack people and beat them up and shoot them if we disagree with the life that they're living. But you know what? We don't have to accept it. And we don't have to endorse it. That's not what the word tolerant means. We don't have to run with them. We don't have to run with them. Because in doing so, if we're approving of things that are sinful, then we're just as guilty. Even though we may not partake of that same sin. If you run with thieves. Okay, number three. Here's our third count. And have been a partaker with adulterers. Okay, so he said, you're running with thieves. But now he says you're a partaker of adultery. One cannot be a passive participant in adultery. Okay, so now they've crossed the line. That's why I separated out these two counts of the indictment. They were running with thieves, meaning they were just associated with those that were wrong. But now they are partakers with adulterers. So now they are actively taking part in that sin. So I'm going to go back to that same verse in Romans, but I'm going to kind of notice the first part. Who practice such things are deserving of death. So whether we are accepting of it or we are in the middle of it, we are just as guilty. So here's the next logical step. From those that run with the bad crowd to those that are the bad crowd. And that was the third count of the indictment. Number four, you give your mouth to evil, he said, and your tongue frames deceit. You know, our words are very powerful, either for good or bad. Tell the truth. Don't lie. Don't try to take something that's wrong and pretend that it's right. Don't take something that's right and try to pretend that it's wrong. Tell the truth. Do not frame deceit. Don't give your mouths over to evil. This is one of the best verses. I want you to remember this verse. It is Isaiah 5 and 20. Try to put this one in your memory. Isaiah 5 and 20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Don't lie. Don't call something that's good evil, and don't call something that's evil good. And have you ever in your lifetime seen more evidence of this than what is occurring in our society right now. To take what is good and call it evil. And to take what is evil and to call it good. I can't. In my 45 years of life, I can't think of anything that I've seen in recent weeks and months. Some of the most strangest things I can't even believe are going on in our country and our society. What is considered good is now evil. And what's considered evil is now good. That's scary. Woe unto those people, Isaiah says, who call evil good and good evil. Finally, our fifth count, he says, you sit and speak against your brother. You slander your own mother's son. Okay, now slander has a little bit different take to it. The idea of slander is when you purposely say something that you know is a lie to try to hurt someone else or to try to damage someone else. Slander is when you say it. If you write it, they call that libel. It's the same idea. But it's where you purposely speak something wrong to try to hurt someone. Not only that, you're trying to slander your own mother's son. You're trying to slander your brother, your own brother, and try to bring your own brother down. He says that's the fifth count of the indictment. So how do you spread an agenda? Trying to enforce something that is spoken against by the Scriptures. How do you do that? Well, you lie. You cheat, you steal, you slander. So again, I'm going to go back to Carl Johnson's book. I thought this was pretty good. This is an article he wrote called Sodom and Gomorrah Revisited. Okay? So in this passage, he's talking a lot about the homosexual agenda. But I don't want you to think it's just homosexuality. It's anything that is against the law of God, that we know is wrong by Scriptures. This is how it is justified. I think this is really good. All of the above, what he's talking about, is just another battle in the continuous war taking place within our culture today. It's a well-known fact that the militant homosexuals have been waging a carefully crafted, decades-old propaganda campaign to redefine our seminal institutions of marriage, family, and God's design for human sexuality. They are led by extreme pressure groups like the so-called Human Rights Campaign, one of America's most powerful and well-funded political lobbies that has an annual budget of over $50 million. Listen to this part. He says the militant homosexual agenda is meticulously laid out in a book titled After the Ball, How America Will Conquer Its Fears and Hatred of Gays in the 90s. The authors of the book are two Harvard-educated marketing experts named Marshall Kirk and Hunter Madsen. They devise a three-pronged approach that the homosexual lobby has been putting into place for over a decade called desensitization, jamming, and conversion. So again, this is not just homosexuality. This is anything that you know is against the Scriptures. This is how you can convince people to do it. Desensitization involves flooding the public with continual gay-related advertising in order to glamorize and normalize homosexual conduct. Hollywood and mainstream media continue to make major contributions to this approach. There's step number one. Try to normalize whatever is wrong. Try to make it glamorous. Whatever is sinful and wrong, whether it's extramarital affairs or it's drug use or whatever you want to do, just make it seem normal and glamorize it. Jamming, number two, refers to the public smearing of Christians, traditionalists, or anyone who opposes the agenda. They will not engage you in rational discussion if you disagree with them. They will just attack you by calling you names, such as homophobe, hate monger, and a bigot. That's where we are right now. Have you ever seen anything like this in our society right now? It is the most polarized world I've ever seen. I mean, it is. There's no discussion on what other side, and whatever the case may be or whatever the situation is, you're on one side or the other, and all you do is call each other's names. And it's going up to the very highest points of our government. I've seen the president make comments that a third grader shouldn't make. I've seen the highest ranking Democratic person rip up a speech to try to prove a point. It's the silliest thing I've ever seen, to try to call people names and try to discredit everything they believe and everything they say, and it's happening on both sides. That is called jamming. Number three, conversion refers to the conversion of the average American's mind, will, and emotions through a steady diet of propaganda via the media. That is exactly what we're facing right now. You sit and speak against your brother's son. You try to bring your brother down. You try to slander everybody you can. And if you disagree with anything anybody says, start calling them names and try to make them look stupid. That's exactly what is going on today. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. But here's the verdict. Verse 21, these things, God the judge says, you have done, and I've kept silent. You thought that I was altogether like you, but I will rebuke you and set them in order before your eyes. So God says, I haven't done anything. I've been silent. So these people are ignorant. They think that God's agreeing with them. That's not the case. Those that hated instruction, boom, guilty. They ran with thieves, guilty. Adulterers, guilty. Lying tongue, guilty. They slandered the brethren, guilty. God, the righteous judge, has declared them guilty on all counts of the indictment. And that's the formal judgment. But even so, God is such a loving and patient God. God is such a God of pardon. Even though they are guilty on all accounts and they're going to be punished for it, He says, I'm going to rebuke you. I'm going to set it in order. God is going to rebuke them. In His closing argument, God says, now consider this, you who forgot God, lest I tear you in pieces, and there be none to deliver. Whoever offers praise glorifies me, and to him who orders his conduct aright, I will show the salvation of God. Even after all this, God said, if you order your conduct aright, if you will get your lives in order and do what you're supposed to do, God says, I will bring forth salvation. James 5 and 11 says like this, indeed we count them blessed who endure. You have heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. And that is exactly true. No matter how guilty we may be, God is always looking for us to have a way out. But we have to get our orders and affairs in line. We have to get our conduct aright to be able to have this salvation of God. So I leave you this question today. Is this not the perfect song for today? I mean, it was written, I don't know, how long ago and what the political and social situation was back in the time of the song of Asaph. But as I read through that, I thought, boy, that is exactly the song that we need to be singing today. Because I'm afraid we're guilty of those same five. We'd be indicted as a nation of those same five things as well. And hopefully that's something that will never come to the church. We need to make sure that we have our affairs in order. That we have our things in line as it's supposed to be done so that we can have that salvation from God. Concludes the thoughts I've had for this morning. We'd never like to close. I have a song invitation. We can help you at any time now. I'm just going to read this.